In trying to meet the challenge which Walt outlined for me, I was confronted with a dilemma, and that is, with a limited period of time, how can I give you what might be of maximal value to you? And so I consulted with him and myself and decided that what we would do is zero in on the synthetic method of approach, which is really one of many that we might use in approaching the biblical text. This is the most difficult, and yet in many respects the most helpful if you can master it. It demands extensive experience, and in my judgment constitutes one of the greatest needs of the church today. We have analysts a dime a dozen. We don't have a synthesizer in a carload. We have people who can break down till they end up with 12 baskets of fragments. But we have very few people who can put things together in a meaningful way and package them so that other people can understand. Now, as you look at the notes, it's divided into three major sections. First of all, I want to define the method for you, then point out three of its critical values, and finally set forth seven procedural steps involved in the process. Let's look at the definition. And by the way, gentlemen, you are welcome to come in at any time with the question. I am a completely non-threatened individual, so you can ask me any question you want. I can answer any question. I can tell you I don't know. That's the shortest of the answers I give. But some of my students come into a class with the philosophy, it's better to keep your mouth closed and appear dumb than to open it and remove all doubt. And I start with the philosophy, it's better to open your mouth and appear dumb than to keep it closed and remain so. So there's no foolish question in here. And I'll work my way through the notes, try to illustrate them for you at various junctures. And if you have any questions at any point, shoot up a hand. We'll go at it. All right, the definition. It approaches a book as a unit and seeks to understand its meaning as a whole. It was Browning who said, image the whole, execute the parts. And this is our objective in synthetic study. Now let's spell this out. First, it does not concern itself with detail. Now this is the great curse of learning how to study a book with an overview. You start in 1-1 in the book, and you run into 16 dozen issues, and you're chasing rabbits for the next 40 hours, with the result that you can't see the forest for the trees. Now, we are interested in details, as we shall see, and the detail as they contribute to the whole. But initially, what we're trying to do is to get the broad outline of the book and its scope. I think it's best understood in contrast with the analytical method. You will remember that in the analytical method, you are moving from the whole to the part, whereas in the synthetic method, you are moving from the parts to the whole. It's the difference between using a telescope in the synthetic approach and using a microscope in the analytical approach. Or, as I sometimes say, in the synthetic approach, you are taking a bird's eye view. In the analytical approach, a worm's eye view. Now, the proper approach to Bible study, it seems to me, employs a combination of both. And this can be illustrated in this little diagram that we set forth for you. And that is, in good Bible study, synthesis is both the initial and the final approach to your study. I differentiate them, as I have done here, by calling this synopsis my original approach, and calling this synthesis as the final approach. over the years in studying the scriptures, and particularly in trying to communicate this to people, I have found that I will get much more mileage with people if I start with a holistic approach of a book, then move into 1-1. Because now the parts take on meaning in light of the whole. After the analysis, then you come back to synthesis. Now, in your study approach, obviously, this is simply tentative. In other words, when I come to a book for the first time and begin to get overall impressions, obviously, I don't know if they're right or if they're wrong. So these have to be confirmed or invalidated. And I can't do that without analysis. But in the final analysis, I don't simply break down, and I'm sure you've heard Bible teachers who do this. We're famous for producing them. And they can tell you about the jussive, and they can tell you about the aorist, and there's a third-class condition here, until, you know, finally most people are lost. They get their ball in some tall weed in the process of this. And you end up, and they get all kinds of details, but they wouldn't have the foggiest idea what the theme of the book is, for example. They couldn't sit down and draw you a little diagram which would explain the overall argument of the book. And the reason for that is that the third state is often overlooked. So when I come to this, this is going to either confirm or invalidate my original tentative observation. Now that's true not only in study, but it's true in teaching. If you want to teach a book, as I'll show you a little later, and see to it that people retain what you teach, I suggest that you use this approach. Begin, first of all, by giving them an overview of the book of Romans. Then start in to the detail of the book. And when you finish, put the thing back together for them and drop it in their laps as a package. And you will accomplish much more, both initially and finally. You will accomplish more initially in terms of motivation. You will accomplish more finally in terms of retention. Now, I think it helps to see the etymology of the term because it's a combination of two Greek words. Soon, which is a preposition meaning together or with, and the, which is the verbal root meaning to place or to put. And the resultant meaning, therefore, is a placing or putting together. In contrast, again, with analysis, which is a taking apart. So if you remember, in this we are putting together. In analysis, you are taking apart. All right, let's underscore in our thinking the values. I've simply stated three of them here.
Dr. Henry?
Yes.
On the definition, you have proper approach employs a combination of both, and just before that you have the letters M, B. So what do they mean?
Yes, this is a Latin term, which you will see quite common in literature, which means nota bene, meaning note well. All right, three values. Number one, synthesis is the basis and the goal of all analysis. As such, I've said it's both the initial and the final approach to the study of any book. Now, there's a reason for this, men, that you ought to keep in the forefront of your thinking, and that is, this is in accordance with the way the mind works. Your mind works best when you move from whole to parts to whole. And if you have ever been given a good tour, it will always follow this approach. Some time ago, I was invited to go to the New York Times to tour that great plant producing the famous paper. And I shall never forget my first introduction because I was so impressed with the planning that had gone into this tour. The first thing they did was to take you into a room just a little larger than this one. And there were pictures on the wall all the way around, four sides, starting over here with the forest where the pulp comes for the production of the paper, all the way around to a little kid selling a newspaper in Times Square. And what they did was to take you through every major step of the process of producing a newspaper. And then after you got all the way to the end, it took the girl about 10 or 15 minutes to tell you the process. Then we went upstairs and started to see every step in the production of the paper. And I had thought of so many tours that I had before, you know, and they take you through one room and here they're doing this. The guy rattles off 16 dozen terms, most of which have no meaning to you. And you don't, you know, everybody's saying, well, where does this fit in? Well, is this first? Or, well, you know, it's just convenient to start here on the third floor and work your way down. But the truth of the matter is you don't have any idea as to how this little part fits into this whole. Now, what you're trying to do is to cooperate with the way God has created the mind. And I say, if you can see the whole, then the parts take on meaning and value. Now, I came from a little two-bit town called Philadelphia and barely saw the light of day until I went to New York. And despite the fact that I lived so close to the city, I had very seldom been there. But, you know, I used to get lost in New York all of the time. So one day I was on the top of the Empire State Building. It was the most remarkable day in New York. You could actually see all of the boroughs. And the traffic was very light, and there was an Irish policeman on the top. And I engaged him in conversation and found him quite talkative, probably a very lonely individual. And explained to him that I was always lost in New York. And I can still remember with the slight brogue him telling me the picture. And he says, okay, it's real simple. There are two rivers, the Hudson River, so forth. These boroughs, he placed them all for me and then showed me a holistic view of the New York area. And I can still remember coming down to the bottom of the Empire State Building. And it's true, I still was lost, but at least I knew where I was when I was lost. I knew I was in Chinatown. I knew I was in the financial district, etc. Because now the parts started to take on real meaning in light of this holistic view, which I had been given. Now there's a second value, and that is synthesis is an indispensable aid to effective communication in any form. Teaching, preaching. My judgment, it's an insult to the intelligence of a class to come in without a plan. I don't know how many courses you've had in formal education, but I've had too many in which not only did the professor not have a plan, but the further we went in the course, the more it became transparent that not only were we lost, but so was he. How far do we go? Well, who knows how far we go? Who cares? If you have two textbooks and you only get to page 117 in the first textbook, it's okay. The rest of it will appear on the exam. But, you know, I mean, how far do we get? Nobody knows how far we get. Every year it's different. And nobody really cares. And it's very interesting to see an awful lot of Bible teaching under the same guy. How many times have I seen a person come even here to the seminary, supposedly to teach a book? He has no plan. He doesn't know where in the world he's going. So we start in and plow through, and the Spirit strikes in chapter 2, so, you know, we camp long here. And then he doesn't move so much, so then we hit Greece for 2 chapters. And he keeps going until finally, you know, the bell rings. That's the last session. Well, may the Lord bless the truth through your hearts, is usually the final parting shot that we get. And, of course, it's usually in the practical section. This always amuses me. So many Bible teachers will take all of this time going through the first 9, 10, 11 chapters of Romans and then say, well, you know, may the Lord bless the remaining truth of your heart. You can get it on your own. And I have the strongest urge to say, really, if I can, why couldn't I get the first 11 chapters on my own? What did you contribute that's so significant? And if it is so significant, I need it for the last part. That's what we've been building for. Now, on page 2, I've given you a little chart to show you what I'm talking about in a specific concrete situation. May I just add a little parenthesis here for you men? Because I know you're interested in the process of disciple-making. I know you're interested in the process of communication. In my judgment, one of the greatest needs today is for teaching books of the Bible as a whole. This is a lost art. And you can see the weakness in the life of the average Christian. He cannot think his way through basic books like Romans, like 1 Peter. Because it's not taught this way. And I really think that if I were in the process of raising a core of disciples, as I am right now, that I would spend more time, as I am doing right now, giving people a holistic view, first of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and then of books, and take them through a series called Route 66, where you give them an overview of every one of the 66 books. In fact, you might start by getting one yourself. Then you'd be in the best position. So after we get through these sessions together, we may synthesize one or two books, and if so, you'll only have 64 to go. And that'll be your assignment from here on out. Now, let's take the illustration of 1 John. 1 John's got 5 chapters, and just for sake of analysis and illustration, let's suppose that you are going to teach the book of 1 John, and let's suppose that each of these chapters were a unit. And let's suppose that you had approximately 5, 6, 7 sessions. If so, this is the way I would structure it, as I have done here. I would take 7 sessions on this book, a session for each chapter, but I would add 2 sessions. I would add an introductory session, which would be a survey, in which I would give people an overview of the book. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, this is motivational. In my experience, that if I give people an overview of the book, the first thing they want after that is, man, I can hardly wait to get into the book. Because you really created a need in this situation. And by the way, I hope you use some overhead projector or a chalkboard or some newsprint if you're in a home. But some means of visualization, and you watch what happens. It'll go every time. I was invited to Fort Worth some time ago to give a series. They wanted an in-depth series on the book of Ephesians, 4 sessions. So, I said, okay. And this was a book where, you know, I mean, a church where there's an evangelistic thrust, but I think really very little Bible teaching. The people are just not used to it. And the interesting thing is to watch most people come to this kind of a session, you know, they look at you like this. And you start in this thing, and the first thing you know, I just flip on the overhead because I asked this guy, you got an overhead? He said, no, I don't. I said, can you get me one? He said, yeah, I think so. So he ran into an overhead. First thing I did was draw my little characteristic lines and start saying, look, there are 2 major parts to this book, outline and so forth. Interesting thing is to watch people look at this thing up there like that, and pretty soon a guy's going like this. And he nudges his wife to get a piece of paper. You know, and you watch him go like this, you know, in his book. Because the urgent thing for him to do is to take notes. Now, the interesting thing is if you'd walked in there and said, look, friend, take notes. You know, I'd say, who, me? We don't do that here. But see, the moment he sees something up there, he thinks, you know, I better get this down. That's good. That's very helpful. Like the third session during that week, this guy came up to me and he said, you know, you're very interesting. you're different. I decided to explore that a little bit and run the risk and said, really, how? Well, he said, you know, I've come to the conclusion that when I come to hear you, I really need a Bible in front of me. see, it's amazing, gentlemen, that people go to church or even to your nav group and throw their mind into neutral. I'm talking about otherwise sharp people. And while I put no magic whatever on notes, I think one of the encouraging things often with the navigator is the moment you start talking to him, he's going to whip out a little notebook and he's going to write something down. And the truth of the matter is, it probably is the main reason why he retains as much as he does. Because he goes through this process. Now, what happens, you see, with most guys, when they're going to start to teach a book like 1 John, is they say, all right, beloved, let's turn to 1 John, chapter 1 today. And so here we are in 1 John. What's in 1 John? Who in the world knows what's in 1 John? Who cares what's in 1 John, conceivably? Well, you know, we plow our way through. How far do we get? Well, we don't know how far we're going to get. We're just going to go, you know, let the Lord lead. And it's pitiful to dump this thing on him. Because he did much more planning and setting forth a book than you're doing in teaching it. And what you're saying to me really is that this is not of equal value, and I don't happen to buy that. I think that if God wrote five chapters in 1 John, I need to know what's in every one of those first chapters, those five chapters. And chapter 1 is no more important than chapter 5 in my book. You don't stratify truth. And what you've got to do is to give people an overview of that thing. So I give them an overview. Which is otherwise, we start in here 1-1, and this guy really gets all revved up and turned around inside out. And so how much do we cover? 1-1 and 2. Next day, it's from 1-3, you know, to 3-9. Because my wife got sick last night, and, you know, all of the reasons that are usually given for it. And usually ends up without finishing the book, whatever. The other thing that I want you to note is that if you'll draw a little line between these, this will help you see. In other words, what I'm saying is that your first one is an overview in which you give people an overview of the entire book. Then you start through and you pace yourself so that if I've only got 45 minutes and it's chapter 1, then obviously I'm not going to be able to tell them everything that's in chapter 1 in 45 minutes. You've got to settle for a limited objective. But that's true anyway. And I have a lot of fun with these students because they say, oh, boy, Rob, I got to cover the material. So you want to cover the material, friend, put it down. Cover it. He says, oh, I can't do that in 40 minutes. I said, what in the world are you talking about? You can't do it in 40 minutes. You can do it in 20 minutes. I'll do it in 5 minutes. I'll just give you 5 minutes worth. That's all. You got 20? Okay, I'll give you 20 minutes worth. You got 3 hours? I'll give you 3 hours worth on the first verse. I mean, how much time? When do you reach the point in arrogance where you can say, I've now covered the material? See, this is always an impossibility because you're dealing with infinite truth. So you've got to settle for a limited objective, okay? So I cover chapter 1. Now remember, the moment I do that, I relate this back to the overview. Tomorrow we come to chapter 2. Okay, so now we go back to the beginning and tie it to chapter 2, chapter 1. In 3, we go back to the beginning. See, what I'm saying then is that this is a building process that you're setting for. And every time, go back to the beginning and bring them up. Ever go to a Sunday school class where they don't do it? Here we are in chapter 1. Okay, next week, chapter 2. The guy comes to chapter 2 and he says, well, I wasn't here last week. Sorry, Mac. That's your problem. It's chapter 2 today. But you see, this is never related to chapter 1. Now, when you come to that last session, what I put down here is a summary. Make sure this is not a rehash. It's got to be a fresh approach. Otherwise, that's the last opportunity you'll get. My judgment, just from a learning point of view, that out of these 7 sessions, if you have followed a building process, beginning at the whole, and then in each chapter going back to the beginning, you will accomplish more in session 7 than you have done in all other 6 sessions put together, though you couldn't do it without them. It's the same thing happens in a process of learning. And that is, the guy gets himself all psyched up, you know, and he spends all these hours in learning. And finally, oh, that clock, here it is, you know, 1 hour from now, I'm on. Why, if he ever accomplished as much in that last hour, I mean, in the other hours as he has in that last hour, he'd be a genius. The reason is that he's got all of the others a foundation. And just sometimes 30 more minutes of study is all a guy would need to perform the difference of an A on an exam and a C. If he just took 30 minutes more to seal it. Now that's what I do in that last summary session. All right, the third thing I said, and that is, synthesis is the best means of apprehending the overall argument of a book. And this is what you want to do. You want to learn to unravel the author's argument. Now, please note, chapter and verse divisions often destroy the unity. If you will remember, the paragraph is the unit of thought, not the chapter, not the verse. None of the books of the Bible was divided into chapter and verse division in the original text. These were added hundreds of years later, supposedly for purposes of convenience, but often they are quite confusing. 1 Corinthians 2 and 3, I think, is one of the classic illustrations of this. Acts 4 and 5, you'll never understand what Barnabas did until you see it in contrast with what Ananias and Sapphira did.
Which Corinthians chapter?
2 and 3, where you have the natural man and the carnal man, so forth, spiritual man. But chapter 3, you see, begin, but I couldn't write unto you this way. And the interesting thing is, when it's taught, you'll come right up to the end of chapter 2 and stop. And just cut the jugular vein of the argument, because it doesn't stop at chapter 2. Even as a unit, it doesn't stop there. I mean, obviously, you've got to stop someplace for terms of time. Secondly, I said, each book or letter was intended to be read as a continuous whole. And most of us don't give the Bible the chance that we give an ordinary 25-cent novel. Nobody would pick up one of these little beat-up novels and starting to read it in the fifth and sixth chapter and condemn the book as uninteresting. But that's what people do with the scriptures all the time. Third, the beauty of a passage depends upon its setting. Now, you will discover I'm a many gifted man. And one of my gifts is art. It will become transparent to you in a moment. I want to do for you one of my latest masterpieces. And I hope that this outfit raises real connoisseurs of art, because you'll be able to appreciate it much more. Takes on its beauty in light of the setting. And once you remove it from the setting, you destroy the beauty. And that's the genius of the synthetic method. That when you give people the setting, then the beauty of the mountain, if you please, is enhanced by virtue of the setting in a synthetic way. It's framed, in other words, to convey one thing. All right, now let's look at the procedure. And there are 7 steps in the process. And we'll probably just get ourselves started today, but this we will do. Number 1, ransack the book. This is where it all begins. It is a process of intensive exploration in which no stone is unturned. You assume the role of a biblical detective looking for clues. And I don't know of anything that to me is more basic to the approach. All right, let's spell this out. There are 3 facets to ransacking. First of all, by repeated reading. There is no substitute for this. The longer I teach students how to study the Word, the more I am convinced there is a direct correlation between people who know how to read and people who get maximal value from the study of the Word. In fact, this is why here at the seminary we're now in the process of setting up a required reading course. Because we've discovered, we get college and university graduates, most of them can't read, they can't write, and they can't think. And I said one day in class, gentlemen, if you don't know how to read, write, or think, what can you do? And one guy hollered out, watch television. And I say, man, if you don't know how to read, write, and think, what is it that you got that's called an education? And I found it's especially true. Now, let me just whet your appetite in this, because I've also hooked a couple of good NAV men with this disease, and they have taken giant steps in the process. Take any book, the book of Romans, for example, and let's suppose, just for illustration, that it takes me 2 hours to read the book of Romans, and I get X results at the end of the 2 hours. And let's suppose by increasing my skill in reading, I can now read it in an hour, but get twice as much out of it. Then for the same amount of time, you see, I can increase it fourfold. And one of the great idiocies of reading is, you know, I'm going to slow down. And when I slow down, I'm going to comprehend more. When you slow down too much, all you do is increase the wool gathering process. See, the genius of learning how to read fast and comprehend much is to keep your mind moving so that other things don't come in. So you can listen from 3 to 10 times as fast as I can talk. It gives you a lot of time on your hands. And it's a lot of wasted time, particularly in the process of reading. This is why the average person, you know, he's supposed to read a chapter a day or whatever his particular increment of scripture is, and so he can check his book and go on his way. But the truth of the matter is, if you met him at the door and said, boo, what did you read? If his life depended on it, he couldn't tell you. And if you read any portion of the scripture and put it down and I say to you, what do you read? And you can't reconstruct what you've read, you haven't read. All right, let me give a couple suggestions here. First of all, when you put beside this, particularly, at one sitting. Now, most of the books of the Bible will not hang together until you read them at one sitting. And I know you're thinking of Jeremiah and Isaiah, etc. But one half of the 66 books can be read in approximately 20 minutes. They are about the size of 2 columns of a newspaper. So we're not talking about an impossible task, even with respect to a longer book. And when I get to a longer book, I just carve out an hour or so. And I sit down and read it at one sitting, beginning to end, without stop. And I found that most books will not hang together. Still remember the book of Matthew. It was sort of a classic departure in my own personal study program. I really sweat over that book, and I could never crack Matthew until I sat down one day and read that thing beginning to end. And when I got through, boy, for the first time, that book started to hang together. Now, Dr. Tenney, in his excellent book on Galatians, which is really not a commentary on Galatians, it's simply Galatians used as a means of showing you how to get into the Word, suggests four reading. First, reading with the purpose of detecting the main theme. Secondly, reading with the view to developing that theme. Third, with the view to unraveling of the author's argument, that is, taking the component parts, putting them together again. And fourth, the development of an outline which will express that theme. Now, please remember, he is talking about a fourfold purpose, not four times. If you don't, that'll blow your mind. I've had students who've read this and then sit down and read it four times, and they said, "Man, I don't even know what the main theme is." I say, "Well, the reason is you're still in the first purpose." I have read a book as many as 35 times before I was convinced I really knew what the theme was. To accomplish number one. Now, he may be talking about four times for himself. He has a photographic mind. Most of us have run out of film a long time ago. And it's my judgment in working with people that this will take more time, but with a fourfold purpose. The second art of ransacking is prolonged meditation. This is the saturation process. It's like getting to know a person. You do that through sustained relations. You do it through continued exposure. Now, let me give you a little key, again, in terms of how your mind works. Your mind works like a muscle. It develops with use. The more you use it, the more you develop it. You will never wear it out. Nobody has ever worn a mind out, period. I have seen hundreds of brains in dissection, and I've never seen one even slightly used. The real skill is going to be in transplanting brains, because when you transplant them, you transplant something that hasn't even been scratched for all practical purposes. Now, the question is, why is it that my mind doesn't do more than it's capable of doing? I'll tell you why. You don't feed it more. The more you feed your mind, the more it flourishes. So you develop what I call the back burner process. You know, you're always shoving stuff on the back burner. You ought to always have something simmering. My wife makes a soup, man, that's absolutely fantastic. I have nicknamed it Enthusiastic Soup, because she throws everything she's got into it. I always know when it's coming. It's always cooked on a Saturday, and it starts about 7 o'clock in the morning. We never get to eat the stuff until 7 at night, and although my boys and I particularly are rifling it all the time. But it just cooks on the back burner, real low flame. You know, and all day long, your gastric juices are flowing like mad because the whole place is filled with it, and it just simmers. So, boy, that flavor gets in there, I'm telling you. By the time you eat it, we just go through a pot in short order. And the reason is the saturation process. Now, feed your mind something all the time. Keep it something so that if I meet you at any time and ask you, "What do you got on your back burner?" You ought to be telling me, "Man, I got it crowded with pots. Which one you want to look at?" And that's especially true and you're driving or doing anything that constitutes wasted time from the standpoint of the mind. You do most of this habitually. Now, it takes me exactly 17 minutes to drive from my home to the seminary. And I drive out this R.L. Thornton Expressway, and that's the most boring route. I have seen everything there is to see on there. And there's nothing else to see except waste time. And I don't waste my time with that. I think my way through books from my house to the seminary. And going back, the same thing. And the interesting thing is, you get an awful lot done during this time. This is when I do a lot of my creative thinking, just by putting stuff on the back all day long. I'm working right now on a sequence in the book of Proverbs. And I just got that baby back there, and it's just stewing like crazy. And coming in this morning, I got here early, fortunately, so I went up to my office and sat down and wrote myself out. I just picked up so much from my house to here this morning. But of course, I've been feeding this an awful lot of stuff now, almost over a period of 2 or 3 years on this particular theme alone. So this is how you do it. Now, I said you need to tarry a while before you become accustomed to the light. The deeper you go, the richer the vein. When the guy says to me, well, I read the passage once, Brock, but I really didn't get too much out of it. I say, look, friend, it's a better, greater commentary on you than it is on the passage. Second, the goal is to develop an at-homeness in the text, or what I call the perspective viewpoint. And I'll give you a good test to tell if you got it. Let's suppose you are working in the Gospel by Mark as an illustration. You do not have this perspective until you can stop at any point in Mark and tell me everything that leads up to that without looking in the text. And tell me everything that follows it. It's when you get to that point that you're really getting the perspective viewpoint. So you think your way through a book. And I'll show you a means that enhances the process no end. It's really a very simple technique. It's simply a process of association. You'll memorize more of the scriptures this way than you ever dreamed of. And you can think your way right through a book. But I say to a student, until you can move in any direction in the text without the text in front of you, you really don't have the book under your belt.
So this introduces the question, how do you relate this to scripture memory and our own approach to scripture memory?
I think this is the best preparation for what you guys are committed to than anything I know. And I'll tell you what it'll do. It'll do what you're interested in doing with people, and that is keep from wresting scripture from the context. Because you can never do that when you know that whole picture.
I say it's a good preparation.
Which I think is good, but what I'm saying is that it's not an either-or tension. And what I want to do is to bring the person to the point of maturity where now he's not simply interested in memorizing isolated verses of Scripture, but he's interested in seeing those Scriptures in their context and the sweep of a book. Because then the verse will take on far more meaning than he ever dreamed of having. The last thing I mentioned is always do this with a pencil or a pen. And a pencil or a pen is like a mental crowbar. And this is why my students just, it's a riot. And whenever they put on a humor number of me, it's always going to be the same type of thing. And that is going to be 16 dozen papers in my file. Because if you look through any of my files or are working on anything, you can see every conceivable type of paper you've ever seen, including toilet paper. You know, if that's at hand. That's what it's going to get written on. Kleenex, napkins. It's just a standard joke that half of the napkins over in the snack shack are designed for Hendrix in his teaching sessions. Because when we get talking, I just whip a napkin out and start drawing the thing for them. And this is the stuff I put in here. So you think yourself clear on paper. And this guy that says, well, you know, I understand it, I just can't express it. I got news for you, buddy. You really don't know it. I mean, it's not until you put that thing down on paper where you say, does that say what you want it to say? Exactly. Does it say it to him? Right. You got it. Now you understand what you're talking about. It's a very exacting but very helpful process. So what you're trying to do, in other words, is to make yourself at home in a book. And develop some degree of mastery. And if you're studying a book of Ephesians, then join the church at Ephesus. If you're in a book of Acts on the journeys, man, get out in the bow of the ship. Feel the spray of the water as you're going across the Mediterranean. You're an on-the-scene reporter. The third step in ransacking. Repeated reading, prolonged meditation, and third, by asking questions. You bombard the text with questions. That stimulates the thought process so that you get on speaking terms with the author. Now, I want to say one other thing because we're going to look at it more in detail. But if you put it here, you'll see the relationship. Always look for relationship. It was Agassiz who said facts are stupid things until brought into relationship. And that's what I like about asking questions. The moment I put something down, I just bombard that thing with 20 or 30 questions. You say, what happens if you can't answer them? That's what I want to know. There are a lot of questions you can't answer in the Bible. Does that bother you? Man, that ought to be helpful to you. Because now this will keep you from being dogmatic on the things you know nothing about. And I maintain all that God has taught me in that book is what I need to know. A lot of things I'd like to know, but I really don't need to know it unless, if I did, he would have revealed it. And the truth of the matter is, an awful lot of it I wouldn't understand anyway. All right, the second step. First, ransack. That's developing this at-homeness in the book. And you can see why that takes a lot of time. Well,
this may be another process altogether, or I looked at the paper, maybe it's you're going to cover later on. Where does the study, the historical setting itself, take place?
Yes, this takes place at the next juncture. Now, I'll show you back on page 4, number 6, the Settige book and its appropriate place in the framework of biblical history. That'll give you a tie-in. But I follow the pattern of first synthesis, then the historical process, then analysis, then thematic approaches. But that would be another approach. It's actually the second of the methods that I take up in this series. All right, secondly, analyze and catalog the distinctive structure of a book. Structure involves the relation and the interrelation of parts. Dyke said, every book is different in structure, though the patterns are often similar. Now, one of the most common of the patterns is what we call epistolary structure. In fact, Paul is particularly fond of this, as you know. And you'll take a book, for example, like Ephesians, and it will divide itself into two major sections, often with an introduction and a conclusion on it. And the first section will constitute a theological foundation, which in this case involves chapters 1 to 3. And then in chapters 4 to 6, you get this experiential superstructure. By the way, please use the proper term. Now, when I see somebody using this, we call it experimental. It is not an experiment. It is an experience. And the proper term is experiential. So that you are moving from doctrine into life. In other words, doctrine is dynamic. It's not divorced from life. It's productive of life. And this is a very favorite pattern with the Apostle Paul, though he does not necessarily use it in every one of his epistles, but very common, so much so that we call it epistolary structure. Now, the interesting thing, for example, to show you a slight deviation on this, really a sub-point on it, is that in the first section of Paul's epistle to the Ephesians, theological section, he gives two interesting intrusions at the end of the first section and then the end of the second section in the book, where in each of these you have a prayer. You remember in chapter 1 and in chapter 3 of the book of Ephesians, you have a prayer. And what happens is Paul reveals a body of truth, then he drops to his knees that the truth that he has revealed will become a part of the experience of the people. Then he gives another tremendous section, and he does the same thing at the end of chapter 3. Now, the thing to bear in mind is that every book is different. No two books are alike. And that's why you've got to study them distinctively. Now, what I've developed for you here are about 6, 7, 8 different ways of looking for structure. First of all, you look for things that are alike. Secondly, you look for things that are different. These are usually in the form of contrasts. Not this, it is this. The works of the flesh are manifest, but the fruit of the Spirit. Look for things that are repeated. Sometimes they're words, sometimes they're phrases, sometimes they're concepts. Hebrews 11 would be a choice case in point. Look for causes and effects, or sometimes the reverse. It will start with the effect and then give you the cause. Look for the movement from general to specific. By the way, put beside that Luke. It's his favorite method. For instance, in Acts, he gives you these little snapshots of what the condition was in the early church, and then he gives you a for example. Have that in Acts 4. Sometimes the reverse is true. Look for progression, for climax, for movement towards something that comes to a focus. Look for questions followed by their answers. That's especially true in the life of Christ. Look for emphasis in terms of space. I just brought along something. It's not my purpose to teach you this, but just to give you a little illustration, because Luke is a good illustration of the law of proportion. Notice the movement in terms of space. From 30 years to 2.5 years to a half year to 8 days to 50 days. Now all you need to do is to draw a line here to realize that in 58 days you have the largest segment as a whole of the book. Because it's obvious that this is the focus of the book. And it's particularly interesting because here you have a half a year devoted to the Samaritan ministry of Jesus Christ, where in Matthew you only have 2 chapters. Here you go from 9 to 19. And in Mark you only have 20 verses. And in John you have practically nothing except an incident out of it. So whenever I'm studying in a passage, the first thing I want to do is to look at this. An illustration just comes to me off the top of my head, man, and that's Genesis, where you have the first 11 chapters dealing, you see, with conceivably hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and beginning at chapter 12 and going through 50, you got 4 generations. So it's obvious which is the more important from the standpoint of the Lord. Now, there are some books that you may be interested in. I just wrote down the author's name here. One is Trainer's book, Methodical Bible Study. Are you familiar with this? Some of you are. The second is the book by Kist, Howard Tillman Kist, entitled These Words Upon Thine Heart. And the third is the book by Olita Wald, The Joy of Discovery. And we use these as texts here in my course. And they're books that are very strong in this whole process of structure. I wish I had a week just to teach you this. It's so exciting and so worthwhile. Because if you learn how to detect structure, you're a long way down the road in this process.
That would be Wald's book?
Wald's book is The Joy of Discovery.
The first
one is Methodical Bible Study by Trainer. Kiss book is These Words Upon Thine Heart, taken from Deuteronomy 6. Yes?
Could you give us a little definition of what you mean by structure and pattern?
Yes, structure deals technically with the relation and the interrelation of terms or component parts. It's how the component parts are put together. You see, you can have the same words, rearrange them in a different order, and you have different structure, conveying a different meaning. All right, the third principle. Discover the organizing principle which gives the book its unity. Now remember, the main quest in a book is for the central theme. What is it that unites this book and makes it a whole? And I've given you 3 questions that I use, which I keep right in my front door drawer file of my mind. Number one, what is uppermost in the mind of the author? Sometimes called the law of principality. What's the big idea? What's the total impression? And what you're trying to do is to distill all of the possibility. And what happens is this. You'll study a book and you'll come up with, you know, this. You get all kinds of parts like that. But what is it that puts these parts together? And your danger is in taking one of these parts and lifting it out and saying, that's the theme. For instance, 1 John is a perfect illustration of this, where a guy says, when I ask him, what's the theme of this? Well, these are written that you might know. So that's very interesting. It also says, these are written that you might have joy. And a few other things. And what you've got to do is to put these together until you get something that you could subsume everything under. Otherwise, you don't have a central theme. You've just taken one part of it and lifted it out. Second question, how is he seeking to develop this? And here you study the format of a book. For instance, is it polemical? And the best illustration I can give you of this is Galatians, which is obviously apologetic. It's argumentative. In fact, you can see it not only in the book, but in the style. The Greek, for example, in Galatians is absolutely broken. It's filled with what we call anakaluthons, that is, things that don't follow through. He just stops right in the middle of a sentence. The same thing you do when you get excited. You say, look, you know we're doing. I told you we're. Now, I don't have any sentence structure in this type of thing. It's all broken up. Are you getting the message? Because I'm hot under the collar. So was Paul. This isn't an academic treatise. This isn't like Romans. If you try to analyze Galatians like Romans, you're in a different book. I mean, man, he's hot, friend. We're not horsing around. He said, we're talking about the gospel. This thing's at stake, man. And he's willing to take Peter and boom, score him right to the face. Out of bounds. Close the whistle. Duplicity. Jews came down. Boy, you changed your clothes, didn't you? Bad news. The tone is in this thing. Very concise. Second, it's interrogative, set forth by a series of questions. The best one, Malachi. The little question, wherein? See, that gives you the whole theme and tone of the book. See, Malachi scores them for their sin. Every time he hits them with their sin, they say, what sin? You know, who, me? You know, the kid in the cookie jar. You know, a cookie stole all of his things. Mom says, hey, but that's good. Well, what cookie? This is them. It's really the sin. The greatest sin of the children of Israel and Malachi is insensitivity. See, when you score a person for a sin and a guy looks at you and says, what sin? Who, me? See, that's his biggest problem. That's why David was the man after God's heart. So that when Nathan said to him, thou art the man, what did he say? Who, me? No, man, he immediately goes down. Well, that's a terrific book. We better not get on Malachi. We'll be here all day. Right, get off on these books. We've had it. All right, third, logical, like a lawyer. Romans, of course, is the classic illustration. 1, 2, 3, therefore. Took a group of lawyers through the book of Romans one time. And they set the whole book up on the basis of a courtroom scene. Absolutely fantastic. The argument, the opposition that he's anticipating. And it's not hard to do with a book like Romans. I want to add a fourth one here. And that is the topical format. And the best illustration of this is Matthew. I think the reason why most people get fogged out in Matthew is that they try to treat it chronologically, and it's not a chronological book. It's a thematic book. And I could give you other illustrations. Well, the third question. What's uppermost in his mind? What's the format? How's he developing it, in other words? And then does any one verse or passage state the idea more succinctly than any other? Sometimes you call it a key verse. Good. Not only find it in a chapter sometimes, but you find it in a section or a book. Let me give you a couple of illustrations. Mark 10:45. obviously the key verse of the Gospel by Mark. The Son of Man came not to be what? Ministered unto, but to minister. That's the outline of the book. The first section deals with the ministry, and the second section deals with his giving his life a ransom. Almost divided in half, actually. That's a verse. If you want a key passage, I'd say the best illustration I can think of is James 2, 14 to 26. This is a very interesting book to me from many points of view, but don't ever look in commentaries in James. Most of them are worthless. It's amazing how much light James throws on James. Just remarkable. Over and over again, I have people say, I happen to write my thesis on this book, so I figure I know a little bit about it. The guy says, well, you know, problem with James' prophecy, you can't outline him. He's just not logical. I said, friend, you tip in your hand. I said, I defy you to show me anywhere, including Romans, better logic, more invincible logic than you have in his argument in 2:14 to 26 on the relation between faith and work. Works, two cycles of thought. Where he presents his argument, he illustrates it, he applies it, and does the same thing over again. By the time you come to the end, friend, you're left without a shred of opposition. So to me, this is the key passage to the book. A chapter, I would suggest chapter 2 of Acts as a classic. The one chapter without which you cannot have the book. So these I look for. Well,
on B up here, you have four of these, clinic, therapeutic, so forth. Is it possible that a book has more than one, or when we're doing it, are we looking for the one that stands out most? For example, I think of Galatians, which is argumentative, but also with set forth questions.
Absolutely. No, you will have more than one. In fact, this is true in your structural law. Same thing. What you're trying to find out, for example, is what is the primary means that he uses to present it.
But we're looking for the primary.
That's right. But not that there will not be more than one. Many times there will be. Now, I think our time is up. Is it not, Walt? We go to 10 of?
Correct.
All right. Can I give you an assignment for tomorrow? Is this permissible? Permissible, but not enjoyable. Well, you know, you don't want to spoil the fun for yourself. You get into it, you won't know how to do it. One of the reasons we put in this reading course is that we don't think anything of asking a guy to read a book before the next hour. He doesn't think too much of it either. But, so I called him.